This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place. The important thing that you've proven to the world is that 500,000 kids can get together and have 3 days of fun and music, and have nothing but fun and music, and I God bless you for it.
Woodstock was the embodiment of 60s peace and love. But just a few months later at Altamont, it seemed like the 1960s came to a violent end. Well, from KCRW, I'm Matt Holzman, and this is The Document, looking at the world through the lens of documentary film.
I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs. I play video games.
A graffiti artist known as Banksy.
How can you let a gook design the memorial?
I tried to tell you, go to Walmart.
The Document is KCRW's mashup of documentaries and radio. This week on the show, an idealistic young filmmaker gets a dream job shooting the Rolling Stones' free show at Altamont. But it turns into a nightmare. I call this episode Psychedelic Misery. Albert and David Maisels are icons of the documentary world. By 1969, they'd already released Salesman, their verite classic about door-to-door Bible salesmen. And then the Rolling Stones hired them to film the end of their U.S. tour. The result was Gimme Shelter, a documentary that would come to symbolize the death of 1960s idealism. One of the shooters they brought in for that fateful job was a young woman named Joan Churchill. Producer Peter Gilstrap has her story.
It's 1969. You're on a mission, choppered into the front lines at the last minute with few, if any, marching orders, dropped into an increasingly chaotic situation where panic, violence, and death seem imminent, and the circumstances are treacherous, unpredictable, and without mercy. Beyond that, you've been drugged against your will. But this scene is not happening in Vietnam, and though Joan Churchill is a shooter, she's armed not with an M16, but with an Eclair 16mm movie camera. And the battleground is the Altamont Speedway Free Festival.
I think afterwards I was just horrified by the whole debacle. But while I was there shooting, I was in the zone. I was just totally into it. It was music, it was a lot of action, it was drama, and I felt I was making cinematic history. You know, I felt it was an important document.
38 Knot KFRC, this is Frank Terry, and let me repeat, the Rolling Stones free concert is going to be on tomorrow at the Altamont Speedway.
As far as Churchill knew, it was going to be a good time. The sexy, benevolent Rolling Stones were offering this complimentary rock and roll extravaganza to the loyal fans of which she was one. It would be a transcendent day of joy, of partying, of young people coming together to celebrate themselves. What could go wrong? Only 4 months before in upstate New York, some 400,000 counterculture enthusiasts enjoyed three blissful days of peace and music. The free event was filmed for what became an Oscar-winning documentary that brought the good time hippie vibe to a theater near you.
I hadn't gone to Woodstock. I knew a lot of people who had worked on the film, but I wasn't there. And for me, it was like a great moment to take my skills and go to this great concert that was going to be the best in the West.
And though Altamont did turn out to be an unforgettable event, it was not for being the best in the West. But let's go back to 1964. Joan Churchill is taking a 6-week class at UCLA Film School. Francis Ford Coppola has just graduated, and future Doors, Ray Manzarek, and Jim Morrison are classmates. For a budding cinematographer with no interest in mainstream Hollywood, the turbulent times offer up shooting opportunities galore.
You know, it was the 60s. There was a revolution in the air. The Panthers were getting into trouble, and the free speech movement was happening in Berkeley. And we were all very wrapped up in all of that. Anytime there was any protest or peace march, we would go with our cameras and film, not necessarily making a film, but just because we knew it was important to document.
But film wasn't the only thing Churchill was passionate about.
You know, I loved music. I played the guitar. I wanted to be Joni Mitchell. It was the scene I loved.
That feel for music dovetailed into her work behind the camera.
Because I understood music, you know, I would understand how songs are built and when the guitar player was going to play and when the drummers were going to do their thing. You know, you get a sense of the development of the music, and so you know where to be with your camera.
Once a year, a special kind of festival is held in a special kind of place. A celebration at Big Sur.
In September of 1969, Churchill and her camera are in Northern California. Filmmaker Baird Bryant hires her as a cinematographer for Celebration at Big Sur, a feel-good folk festival in the wake of Woodstock, which happened only a month before. Meanwhile, the Rolling Stones, who haven't played in America for 3 years, launch a tour on November 7th in Denver. Mick Jagger is intent on creating a film of the experience, one that will be crowned by a free show in glorious San Francisco. Jagger approaches D.A. Pennebaker, the man behind Bob Dylan's Don't Look Back and the beatific Monterey Pop. Pennebaker passes. Next, Jagger hits up Oscar-winning cinematographer Haskell Wexler.
So Haskell went over, and they were staying in Laurel Canyon, and he spent a day or a couple of afternoons there, and he was just so unimpressed, and everybody was stoned, and he wasn't into the music. So he called the Maisels, Al and David, and said the Rolling Stones were doing a concert in Madison Square Garden, and they needed a film crew, and would they like to do it, the Maisels? And Al says that they didn't know who the Rolling Stones were.
The Maisels quickly discover who the Stones are, and they agree to shoot the last days of the band's traveling spectacle as it moves toward the free show in Northern California. And then, on November 28th, at a press conference in Manhattan, Jagger says this.
I read in one of the papers that you'll be giving a free concert in San Francisco.
We are doing a free concert in San Francisco.
When?
On December 6th. And the location is not Golden Gate Park, unfortunately, but it's somewhere adjacent to it, which is a bit larger.
He just made that up. Neither Mick nor anyone else has a clue where this show will land. But by this point, tens of thousands of fans across the country have begun their pilgrimage toward a concert that has no stage, let alone toilets. With less than 24 hours until showtime, the Stones are desperate. That desperation leads them to a dying racetrack in a small town called Livermore. Woodstock took place on a dairy farm in lush, green, upstate New York. In stark contrast, Altamont Speedway is isolated, barren, godforsaken, and a full 50 miles east of San Francisco. The windswept brown scrubland is accessible only by a winding two-lane road. There are virtually no facilities. And for $500 in beer, the Hell's Angels will guard the stage. In $1969, that's a lot of beer. Back in L.A., Joan Churchill gets a phone call. She's hired on, along with 22 other camera people that include some guy named George Lucas, to shoot the show. Beyond that, her instructions are somewhat south of minimal.
I personally never had any kind of a meeting with anybody. I'm told there were production meetings. I was either already shooting or I was stoned when these meetings had happened. So I can't tell you anything about the organization. So Friday night, I'm on a helicopter flying in to the Speedway in Altamont.
When she plants her buckskin-clad feet on the ground, it's long after dark. The glow of campfires dot the desolate hills, but it's hard to see, hard to get any sense of the size of the crowd. People are camped out in tents, laying out on blankets, and crashed out on American flags. Churchill shoulders her camera and begins wandering through the scattered throngs who huddle against the cold like refugees. It's the calm before the storm. There's no sense of what the next day will bring.
And what I was smelling was a lot of grass being smoked, you know, jugs of wine being passed around. People were sitting around fires. They would make these bonfires. It was very, very mellow.
At this stage, things at the Speedway can still pass for groovy.
I had been told that I should do some shooting and then just tell the security that I was with the Maisels and they'd let me in and I could go to sleep. They didn't say where. So I shot for a while and then I went to the security and they were like, who the fuck are the Maisels? You know.
Bear in mind, this is 1969. There are no cell phones, no tablets or laptops. Walkie-talkies exist, but Churchill says the crew would have been lucky to get tin cans and string. So basically, communication is non-existent. By morning, the crowd is massive, growing bigger, and very bored. Apart from drugs, there's not a lot to do. But there are plenty of drugs, and people are doing them.
Hashish. LSD. Psilocybin.
I was walking through the crowds, and people were offering me food and drink, and I hadn't eaten or had anything to drink, and so I helped myself and pulled out my light meter and saw rainbows coming out of it. And I was like, oh my God, somebody's given me acid.
You're listening to The Document from KCRW. We'll be back in a minute.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Matt Holzman, and this is The Document from KCRW. Today's show, Psychedelic Misery. In 1969, a young filmmaker named Joan Churchill was one of the people hired to shoot the Rolling Stones' free concert at the Altamont Speedway in Northern California. It was a dream job until it turned into a nightmare. Someone, she still doesn't know who, dosed her with LSD. But she wasn't the only one there tripping hard.
There was a lot of bad drugs being passed around. And I think unwittingly, a lot of people took LSD and they didn't have a clue.
Near the stage, exactly where Churchill is heading while her brain sizzles on LSD, there is discord and violence.
There was so much people wanting to get to the front so they could see and hear that there was a lot of shoving and nastiness, and it just turned really ugly, especially when the Hells Angels came in.
With the Angels and the Acid doing their respective deeds, blood and bad trips are piling up.
We need ace bandages, gauze, and sponges.
Medical facilities and supplies are almost non-existent. It's not yet noon.
We need a doctor under the left-hand scaffold as soon as possible, please.
They're not going to play music till we get a doctor. Somebody help. Somebody's hurt.
They get a doctor. The music continues.
The Jefferson Airplane. Jefferson Airplane.
Tripping Churchill finally stumbles to the front of the stage.
I climbed under the stage and just tried not to hear what was happening and tried to keep my eyes closed. It was the worst. And the Hells Angels were right there, knocking heads and kicking people, and it was all just right in front of me. And the stage wasn't very high either. It was, I couldn't stand up under there at all. So I was kind of just squatting. And it was 8 hours of pure psychedelic misery.
Hey, man, I'd like to mention that the Hells Angels just smashed Marty Ballin in the face and knocked him out for a bit.
This is what's going on a few inches of plywood above Churchill's head. And while the Jefferson airplane are fighting the Angels topside, underneath, she's fighting with herself.
First of all, I was there to do a job, and I felt really bad about that. I felt terrible that, you know, I was not going to be able to shoot. And then secondly, I felt that I was, you know, I was going to die.
During Churchill's full day of drug-induced agony, the crowd has swollen to the population of a good-sized city. But again, this is 1969. There's no jumbotron offering a close-up view of the stage, no way for the vast majority of people cramped together toward the horizon to know what's going on, why the music keeps stopping and starting. On the front lines, it's a different scene.
To keep people in line, but the Angels also, you know, you don't bust people in the head for nothing. So both sides are fucking up temporarily. Let's not keep fucking up.
And so it goes. Finally, the sun is down, the moon is up, and the temperature is dropping. Some 2 hours late, the Rolling Stones finally step onto the stage to greet their simmering mob of an audience.
Oh, babies.
There's so many of you. Just be cool down the front and don't push around. Just keep still, keep together. Oh, yeah.
The song is defeated by the commotion in the crowd. Mick stops doing his jittery rooster dance. Master frontman is rattled, losing what little control the band has.
I'll try and stop it. Hey, people, sisters, brothers and sisters, brothers and sisters. Come on now. That means everybody just cool out.
By this time, Churchill's coming down from her trip. The rainbows are gone. She's ready to open her eyes, emerge from her shelter beneath the stage, and shoot
everybody
into the heart of darkness.
I probably got dosed with acid around, you know, 8:30 in the morning. So by 4 o'clock, I was back. I was okay. I was ready to go.
Churchill is assigned her very own Hell's Angel bodyguard, a big, sweet blonde fellow, she says. She stakes out a spot on the back of the stage on top of a gear case and looks through her camera.
And then I found this guy at the front of the stage. He was sitting, and I watched his face, and I saw the same look of horror that I had just gone through, and I knew that this man was freaking out.
Just keep cool, and let's just relax. Let's just get into a groove. Come on, we can get it together. Come on. Sit down.
I became transfixed watching him with my camera. I must have shot an entire roll of film on this guy. And Mick Jagger was prancing around in the foreground. I wasn't interested at all in Mick. I was just watching this guy writhe, and his face would contort, and his eyes would roll back, and his body would clench. And finally, a Hell's Angel noticed that he was there and grabbed him and threw him off the stage. It was like this incredible rush for me, this magical moment, because I just knew that what I was shooting was gold.
What Churchill captures on that roll of film will be one of the most memorable, defining moments in Gimme Shelter, and one that other shooters behind other cameras that night will lay claim to. But they are wrong.
I just would never forget that I had done that shot. You just know that it's something you've done because you've lived it. You've lived it through the lens. And you've also, you know, had some sort of emotional reaction to it. So it's just part of your history.
Baird Bryant, the man who hired Churchill for this gig, is about to earn his own chunk of history. Perched on a truck with his camera trained on the audience, he shoots yet another scuffle. But this is a lot more than yet another scuffle. Meredith Hunter is an 18-year-old African-American. He's at the concert tonight with his 17-year-old girlfriend, Patty Breidehoft. Hunter's wearing a flashy, bright green suit and stands out from the crowd. What they'd realize later is that Bryant's camera captures Hunter brandishing a .22-caliber revolver visible against Patty's white crochet top, followed by Hell's Angel Alan Passaro leaping toward Hunter, his right arm arching high in the air, fist gripping a knife, and slamming it down into Hunter's back. And then Patty screams.
There were many commotions and explosions happening. And from where I was standing, you'd see all these people, and then you would just see almost like a wave going through of arms and bodies being thrown about. And you knew something was happening, but you couldn't really tell what it was.
Of the roughly 300,000 people there that night, virtually no one knew what it was, including Baird Bryant. The Stones deliver 15 songs, ending with Street Fighting Man, then leave the stage clearly shaken and disturbed. The five band members and 12 others jam themselves into an overloaded helicopter that can barely rise into the night sky. And they weren't the only ones leaving the scene of the crime.
The Maisels had fled. The Maisels had actually fled before the end of the Stones concert by helicopter. I didn't know that until much later.
As for Churchill's next few hours?
I don't remember. I think we got out of there finally, but I have no recollection of how. It's like been wiped from my mind.
Though the film has yet to emerge from the developing lab, the news of the stabbing is out.
This is Stefan Ponick, KSAN Radio, San Francisco. Well, the Rolling Stones tour of the United States is over. They wound it up with a free concert at the Altamont Speedway for more than 300,000 people. We've received word that someone was stabbed to death in front of the stage by a member of the Hell's Angels. Nothing's confirmed.
In the days just after the concert, back in Los Angeles, Churchill finds herself with an unusual post-production task.
Baird Bryant and I were the people that went to the lab afterwards and picked up the dailies, and it was our job to look through them and see if we could find the murder, because we didn't know at that point if the murder had been captured on film.
After going through miles of raw, soundless footage, it's Bryant who actually discovers the scant few frames that reveal the deadly stabbing. And as much as the Maisels and the authorities want to find that incriminating death footage, there are other parties who feel differently, including the head of the Hell's Angels.
We were going through the footage looking for the murder, terrified that Sonny Barger was roaming around looking for us. And we knew that Sonny had put a hit out. And, you know, it was kind of scary times.
Meredith Hunter's isn't the only death that night. In the mass exodus after the music has ended, two people will be killed in a car accident, another by drowning. And what was intended to be a documentary of the Stones' triumphant return to America becomes evidence in court of a murder and the indelible cinematic death knell of an era.
I think that experience, for me, was the nail in the coffin of the 60s. You know, it was, the romance was gone. I had this feeling of evil that I just couldn't shake after working on that, just spending that one day in Altamont.
The film Woodstock serves up a peaceful, easy version of the 60s trip that for many still lingers today. Gimme Shelter is the bleak, nihilistic counterpunch, revealing something far more disturbing than just acres of long hair, ill-advised nudity, and unbridled violence set to music. It tells a different truth and lays waste to nostalgia.
Well, you know, a lot of people will disagree with me, but I see the 60s as a period of incredible self-indulgence. A lot of people were taking drugs. A lot of people were dropping out. There was no impulse control. There was no... It was just very, very self-indulgent. I watched you
suffer. Joan Churchill didn't put her camera down because of her experience at Altamont. In fact, quite the opposite. She's had a remarkable career as a documentary filmmaker, shooting everything from Kurt and Courtney to Last Days in Vietnam. And that's the document for this week. Thanks to independent producer Peter Gilstrap for today's amazing story. For more stuff about what you heard on today's show, including some pictures that Joan Churchill sent us, go to kcrw.com/thedocument. We've also got information and links to the clips in the intro to the show. If you want to communicate with us, send us an email at thedocument@kcrw.org or get social at documentkcrw on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Matt Holzman. Mike Schlitt and I produced today's show with Sarah Pellegrini and Bridget Kelly with the support of KCRW's Independent Producer Project. The spectacular mix was by Ray Guarna. Gary Scott is KCRW's program director. The Document is a production of KCRW.